Good afternoon. Welcome to the November 28th edition of CNI Conversations. I'm Cliff Lynch, the director of CNI, and with me I have Joan Lippincott, our associate director. I trust that those of you in the United States have had a good Thanksgiving holiday, and we have quite a number of things we wanted to fill people in on that have been happening over the last couple of weeks. The place I want to start is with a reminder for those, primarily for those in the United States, although I guess they would probably also happily take comments from relevant parties around the world, is a pair of calls for comments that have come out of the U.S. Office of Science and Technology Policy. I posted pointers to these on the CNI announce list a couple of weeks ago, but I think that these are important opportunities for comment, and I wanted to provide a little more background on them. As I say, there are two calls for comment, and individuals or organizations are invited to provide comments on either one or both of the calls. The first call deals with open access to federally funded scientific research. The sort of thing that has been achieved for research funded by the National Institutes of Health through their mandate for the last couple of years. And here, the Office of Science and Technology Policy is seeking comments on the pros and cons of extending this kind of a mandate to all federally funded research, as well as a number of issues having to do with embargo periods, with the roles of publishers in this work, and, for example, whether the articles should be submitted to some kind of central site similar to PubMed Central. There's quite a lot of specifics that the government is inquiring about to help guide their policymaking. My recollection is that the due date for comments on that is the 2nd of January, 2012. This call is somewhat similar, I believe, to a call for comments that they put out a year ago and is being issued under the provisions of the America Competes Act. The second call for comments deals with access to data sets that are produced as part of federally funded research. So parts of this get to questions about the data management plan mandates that the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation have put in place, the appropriateness of extending these kinds of requirements to all federally funded research, no matter what agency is funding it. There are a number of operational kinds of questions having to do with standards, with where this kind of material is best housed, and when that's best done on an institutional and when on a disciplinary basis. There's also an interesting thread that runs through both calls for comments, and that's about the kind of broader economic impact of making this material available, whether this will lead to the launch of new businesses, whether it will lead to job growth, to innovation, to greater economic productivity. And I think that's a worthwhile question to be asking, and one that I think many of the people in our community may want to weigh in on. The second call, dealing with access to data, I believe has a due date of the 12th of January. So we don't have a lot of time for either of these. A number of scholarly and professional societies, I believe, are going to submit comments. I think CNI is going to put in some comments. I've been led to believe that SPARC and the Association of Research Libraries will probably submit comments to one or both of these. I know a number of universities are going to be submitting comments, and I think certainly the more thoughtful input we can provide the policymaking organizations on this, the better. Also, while we're on the subject of policy, you may remember a report that came out of the European Union about a year ago about surfing the wave of data. This was a very high-level view of some of the opportunities that were emerging through data-intensive science in Europe. I want to note, and again, I've put specifics on this out to the CNI announced list, that a project called the Knowledge Exchange, which is supported by key groups in four countries, CERF in the Netherlands, JISC in the United Kingdom, the DFG in Germany, and the State and National Library and Archives in Denmark, have issued a sort of a response to this, a surfboard for riding the data deluge. It's nice to see that at least in Europe you can get away with a good pun in a report. But this is a very helpful report that is worth reading, and I think captures a good deal of the thinking about response to the data deluge and to data-intensive scholarship in the European framework. There are a couple of meetings that I want to mention, and it seems like both Joan and I have been to an extraordinary number of meetings in late October and early November, and certainly there are quite a few more coming up between now and the CNI fall meeting. Many of the things that I've been to have been advisory group sorts of meetings, and I don't really have too much to say about those at this point. But one that I did want to say a few words about was a really very interesting meeting that Stan Katz of Princeton University convened at the Center for Jewish History in New York. This was a high-level meeting that brought together a number of organizations, including the Library of Congress and the National Library of Israel, plus a huge array of archives, research libraries, and other groups holding important Jewish manuscripts and other kinds of historical materials to talk about the prospects for digitizing these in support of historical scholarship. Many of the ideas really were not entirely new. They were the sort of things that have emerged as people have looked at other archival collections, certainly. But the scope of the material available here and its richness is really quite striking. One of the kinds of systems I saw displayed there among the demos that was very interesting was actually not so much about digitizing manuscripts or even digitizing artifacts, but of documenting place. There are a number of projects that are underway that are trying to document historic Jewish sites of various kinds, Jewish quarters in cities, which in many cases you know, have now been completely repurposed and changed. There's a fascinating sort of historical documentation prospect here, and also some very interesting echoes of the sort of crowdsourcing and citizen humanities and history that seems to be emerging in so many settings. There will be web pages coming up documenting the presentations at this meeting, and I will share those when they are available. I think I'd like to invite Joan at this point to say a few words about the Berlin 9 meeting where we were also represented.
Thanks, Cliff. Some of you, in fact, many of you may be familiar with the Berlin Open Access Declaration. And it was originally issued in 2003 by international research, scientific, and cultural institutions and promotes the internet as a medium for disseminating global knowledge through open access. And there have been a number of conferences, obviously this was the ninth, held that have been inspired by the Berlin Open Access Declaration. And Berlin 9 was the first of the annual meetings that took place in North America, and it was fully subscribed. They even had an overflow room for attendees. The organizing institutions for this meeting were SPARC and ARL, the Max Planck Society, HHMI, and the Marine Biological Society. And I'm just very briefly going to give you a few examples from some of the presentations that were highlights for me. Harold Varmus, who's at NIH and who's really one of the key leaders in the government who pressed for open access of scientific and medical publications, gave a wonderful talk. And I was particularly taken by his saying that recently he had tried to access a particular medical article that was published within the last 6 months and found he was denied access. Oh, I think that publisher may rue the day that that Harold Varmus wanted to access the publication and didn't have affiliation with an institution that was licensed to access it. And so his thoughts on this were that what we currently are calling open access is not good enough. And this refers to the fact that the current law permits a time period in which a publisher may keep an article that was produced through federally funded research in a closed system before it's made put into an open access archive. And he believes clearly that the locking it up for even a short period of time is not going to be acceptable in the long run. Another key leader came from the World Bank. In the past year, they have made available all of their data sets that they've been collecting over the years. I think this is a phenomenal step and one that perhaps isn't as well known in higher ed institutions as it should be. They're also, in order to make some of the data more usable, that very day, they were opening a new financial portal so that regular citizens would have an easier time understanding how to access the data. And they've also created an iPhone app for the data. They want to broaden their work with data to local communities, and they're trying to figure out what they need to do in terms of developing analysis tools, mapping software, etc., to make their data more useful to the general public. And I think we'll see a lot of agencies doing similar types of work. Philip Born from the PLOS Computational Biology Journal had an example of a 15-year-old student that he had talked with who did some remarkable work and a presentation at a national conference by compiling data on pandemics all through access to open data. And so the conference concerned not just open access to publications, but there was quite an emphasis on open access to data. For those of you that are asked, how do we know that open access is really working? Elliot Maxwell from Penn State gave examples of four papers that demonstrate the value of open access in different ways. I'm sure you'll find information about all of these presentations, including slides and, in some cases, I believe, videos on the Berlin 9 site. And I encourage you to explore this really wonderful set of presentations. Back to you, Cliff.
Thanks. One of the other places that I had an opportunity to get to this fall was the annual Charleston meeting that Katina Strauch and her colleagues put on. This is an amazing meeting. It's gotten tremendously large and tremendously diverse. I can remember attending early Charleston meetings when I was back at the University of California in the early 1990s. Back then, it was the place to go to talk about journal licensing and database licensing and similar sorts of issues, and also the place to go to do deals around this at the fringes of the meeting. It was perhaps 200 people back then, and now it's up well into the thousands range. It really takes over the entire city of Charleston. One of the things I did there was I shared a closing plenary session one afternoon with Lee Dirks from Microsoft Research, where we got to do kind of a fast forward through a series of conversations that really have been going on for about a year now. These include, they've been strung through a series of workshops and other kinds of small meetings with a ever-changing cast of people that includes some technologists, some people from both the commercial publishing world, from places like Elsevier, and from the open access world, from groups like the Public Library of Science. They include some technology folks, a number of people who are committed to various forms of open science, and some of the meetings that have moved this forward were the Beyond the PDF meeting that was held early this year in San Diego, the workshop that Harvard University and Microsoft Research jointly sponsored this October, a meeting over in Europe called Force 11, I believe. Basically, all of these meetings share a sort of a sense that it is really time to go beyond scientific articles that simply mimic print on paper, to begin to deal with a group of about seven or eight interrelated issues: how you merge data or interconnect data and articles, how you deal with review, assessment, and impact of articles, particularly in environments where you're not necessarily doing pre-publication peer review, but also where you are using strategies like bibliometrics or web metrics of various kinds to allocate attention to material as it comes out. They are interested in data citation, in how data can be appropriately archived and connected to the scientific literature. A really very interesting agenda of this kind. And we did a sort of a very, very quick trip through half a dozen prototype projects and a number of ideas coming out of this. There should be video available of this soon if there's not already. One thing I do particularly want to note that's interesting is that both Google Scholar and Microsoft Research's academic search system have been making some considerable improvements lately in trying to establish what are, in essence, researcher persona and allow people to clean up citations, to disambiguate them, to merge together things that you may have published with or without your middle initial, and to disavow things that somebody else with the same initials and last name as you might have published as not being yours. These systems also compute a number of the new sort of experimental scholarly impact factors like the H index and the G index as they go. And it's going to be quite interesting to see how people, whether people spend time cleaning up their own scholarly bibliographies online. What use they make of this. One thing that I'll particularly note that's very frustrating right now is that the updates don't propagate from one to another. So if you really want to clean yourself up online, you need to do it on Google, you need to do it on Microsoft, and then you need to go to commercial services such as ISI's Web of Science or Scopus and clean it up there. One of the things that we can, I think, really hope for is that if and when author identifiers take hold, we can set up some sort of clearinghouse or propagation from service to service so that changes you make one place will move on to others. I think we'll be hearing a good deal more on all of these topics over the next year. There is, at least in my view, a good deal of momentum building up around them. The last thing that I want to just mention, because it was really kind of a special evening for me, was that I had the opportunity during Open Access Week to go and give the McCusker Memorial Lecture at Dominican University just near Chicago. And I chose to talk there about lives and bibliographies and the relation between bibliography and biography. I'm hoping to be able to get this written up over the next couple of months and perhaps circulate it for some comments before publication. So you can look forward to more from me on those topics, but that really was a wonderful opportunity, I'm really looking forward to casting these thoughts and speculations into a more final form. Before I wrap up with a look at some of the forthcoming things for the next few weeks, I want to turn it back over to Joan to talk a bit about assessment. Assessment, as I think many of those in the CNI community know, is something that just seems to be getting more and more emphasis. It's so tied in with accountability, with measuring success, with a whole set of important trends. We've got a significant session scheduled for the CNI fall meeting in a couple of weeks, which Joan will be leading, dealing with some aspects of assessment. And she's going to share some of the kind of framing thinking that's driving that session.
So as Cliff said, educational assessment is a topic that's currently receiving a lot of airtime, both in the popular press and in the higher ed community. It's the kind of subject that can provoke visceral reactions, often negative, from members of the educational community, especially from faculty. I believe the negative impression that many have of assessment is primarily due to one or both of these factors. Some assessment measures are conceived of in very simplistic terms and are used to prove that learning has taken place or value has been added or something, when the reality might be much more complex than the measure reveals. Second, assessment takes resources, particularly time and energy, and often designated funds. And when the assessment process is completed, even if there are some obvious recommendations for changes, nothing actually happens sometimes as a result of the assessment, and therefore people feel assessment's a waste of time and resources. But in today's political climate of accountability in higher ed, here are some of my own thoughts on what I believe assessment can help us achieve. When there are clear problems, such as a lack of persistence in a particular major, or lack of degree completion, or inability for high percentages to get a passing grade in important prerequisite courses, assessment can help pinpoint problems and point to solutions. And assessment can also inform us about whether remedies put into place have actually addressed the problem. Second, when we'd like others to understand what has been accomplished in a program, or a curriculum, or even a facility, such as a new classroom building or a new learning commons, developing qualitative assessment measures that result in a case study or other narrative about activities, learning, and interactions that have been achieved can be a useful tool for informing constituencies, and these would be people in upper administration or funding bodies about the benefits and, in fact, future needs of the targeted activity. And third, going through an assessment process can assist programs and institutions in clearly identifying what they are trying to accomplish through curricular change or implementing new technologies or designing new facilities, and then finding ways to operationalize those goals into factors that can be measured so they can really understand if they're achieving their goals. At our December CNI membership meeting, I'll be part of a project briefing that will focus on assessment of learning spaces. Joining me will be Malcolm Brown, director of the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative, ELI, who will describe their Seeking Evidence of Impact project, and I'm on the advisory group of that initiative, and they're looking at broadly across institutions to find out what they're doing to see how technology may genuinely impact learning. Also, Jeannie Narum, head of the Learning Spaces Collaboratory, will be describing her initiative funded by NSF to develop some questions that will assist institutions in understanding the contribution of physical spaces to learning. I also helped facilitate a workshop on that topic just a couple of weekends ago, sponsored by the Learning Spaces Collaboratory. I continue to be interested in how we might do a better job of assessing the impact of information commons or similar facilities on learning. In addition to improving students' overall education experience, opening up technologies and digital resources to enrich their learning, and promoting student creation of new digital materials, I believe information commons may also have a broader impact related to student success and students' sense of belonging to a campus culture. We'll discuss these issues in our session at the meeting and encourage your own examples and thoughts on assessment. And CNI will continue to work on assessment activities as part of our programmatic work. Back to you, Cliff.
Thanks again. And I'll just conclude by running down a few upcoming meetings that we're going to be at and a couple of upcoming talks. Later this week, on November 30th, there is a meeting on repositories that Cindy is putting on at the Library of Congress. This I'll be speaking at this, and this promises to be particularly interesting because some of the focus is going to be on emerging developments in federal agency-based repositories as distinct from institutional repositories that might be housed at higher education institutions. There have been some developments there in the last couple of months, and I'm looking forward to learning more about them. Next week, there is the International Digital Curation Conference in Bristol in the UK. CNI has been a longstanding co-sponsor of these meetings, and the program for this one looks wonderful. I hope I will see some of you there. On the way back from Bristol, I'm going to be making a quick stop in Rotterdam to do a keynote at the Digital Humanities European Conference, DISH 2011, which, again, it looks to me to be a wonderful program and will give me an opportunity to reconnect with a number of European colleagues who are interested in how cultural heritage institutions are changing in the digital world. I'll certainly report back on all three of these meetings in future future CNI conversations. We then have, of course, the Fall CNI member meeting the following week, and I hope I'll see many of you there. Then just to wrap up the year on December 16th, Friday, after the CNI meeting, I will be giving a talk out at the National Library of Medicine, National Institutes of Health, and when I get the details on that, I will share that out with CNI Announce as well for those who might be interested in that session. So, it's going to be a busy few weeks. I know that Joan and I are both very excited about the way our fall meeting has shaped up, and I hope that I will see many of you there or in other spots. Thanks for joining us today.